Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Robert Rosenthal, Executive Director of the Center for Investigative Reporting. I'll be your chair today for today's program called Afghanistan. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speakers. Tamim Ansari was born in Kabul, where his father was a university professor and his American mother taught English in Afghanistan's first school for girls. Tamim left for the U.S. in 1964. He is a writer, lecturer, editor, teacher, and director of the San Francisco Writers Workshop. He has written several noteworthy books and award-winning books, including A Game Without Rules, The Often Untold History of Afghanistan. He'll sign this book after the program today. Atta Argan Diwal was also born in Kabul. His father was a prominent military officer and leader. After high school, Atta served in the Afghan or Air Force. When the political situation changed in the 1980s and the Russians invaded, Atta fled to Germany and then came to the U.S., where he has enjoyed a successful banking career. Like Tamim, he was shocked by 9/11. He visited Afghanistan recently, and you can read about his amazing journey back to Afghanistan in his book, Lost Decency, an award-winning book, The Untold Story of Afghanistan. He will also sign the book after the program. I think today's program is going to be very interesting. You may hear different perspectives. You're going to learn a lot about the history of Afghanistan. And if you read these two books, which are both wonderful books, you'll get, in one, Tamim's book, The Context and the History of Afghanistan. If you read Atta's book, you'll see a character who comes to life during part of the period of history we're going to talk about today. So we'll start off. Welcome, please welcome Tamim.
Thank you all for being here. Thank you to the Commonwealth Club. Let me just check the time so I don't go over. All right, so I'm sure all of you are very interested in what's going on in Afghanistan right now, who is contesting for the presidential seat in the elections next year, what happens after the NATO forces withdraw, if they do. But as a historian, and we can get into all that with questions and so on, but as a historian, what I'm interested in is how we got here. And I feel that how we got here is part of the question of where do we go from here. In this book, Games Without Rules, I've gone back to what I consider the origins of the Afghan nation state, which is about 2.5 centuries ago, and I trace the narrative arc of that country, that emerging developing country, which has still not quite developed. I will note that the origins go back to about the same period that the United States was taking shape, late colonial era. And what I see is that in that early period, this territory that we now call Afghanistan was populated by many tribes, clans, different populations, but it was also permeated by a sense of uniformity of culture, of which Islam was perhaps the most important binding factor, but there were also values in common, a sense of common history, and something about the social structure that you would find. So that, you know, there were various levels of power, but the people in the villages and the people in the cities and the rulers and the peasants and the poor and the rich, they might have conflicts, but they considered themselves all to be part of the same world. Then in the course of history, what happened is that a very different cultural entity suddenly appeared on the Afghan scene, and it was pressing in on this area. And these were the global powers whose culture was basically Western and who saw this territory as an important spot because of strategic considerations in their contests with each other globally. So now, for the Afghans, for anybody who was part of the ruling elite in Afghanistan or wanted to rule the country, it was necessary for them to negotiate with two very different entities. And one was the outside power, whoever that might be, the British, whatever. And then there was, the old Afghanistan, the original Afghanistan, this world of clerics and elders that came from the grassroots and the villages, and the networks, the tribes. And that world still had its, you know, the old culture that characterized the life in this area. So what I find is that over time, in the way that, you know, if you put a liquid in a centrifuge, the heavier stuff separates from the lighter stuff. There's some sense in which Afghan society also separated into two societies. And there was this urban westernized elite, and there was this other inward-looking old country that was Afghanistan. And these are both Afghan, these are both aspects of Afghan society. And they're in contention and have been in contention for control of the identity of Afghanistan. So this is a story that's been going on in Afghanistan from the beginning, partly caused by the various incursions and interventions. But then there's the separate story, which is that every 40 years or so, without fail, like clockwork, well, not quite like clockwork, but about every 40 years, some foreign global power has tried to come in and dominate the Afghan scene and control it and use it for its own purposes. There have been periods of Afghan history when the rulers of Afghanistan have taken advantage of the geographical position of Afghanistan to play a sort of a neutrality card, using the favoritism towards one global power, playing that against the possibility of leaning towards the other global power to keep both of them somewhat at bay. And this has been the diplomatic strategy of successful Afghan rulers whenever there have been any. And the Cold War, for example, was a notable period. Both the USSR and the United States were interested in Afghanistan. They both were competing to enlarge their influence in the country. And somehow, because of the counterbalancing of those two forces, there was a period when Afghans were sort of in control of their own destiny. And during that period, you saw modernization and change in Afghanistan that was more rapid and more sort of dramatic than you've seen anywhere, in this country. That period ended when the pendulum of trying to swing back and forth between the inner Afghanistan and the outer world, it started to swing so fast and so far that it finally crashed, and the country succumbed to a coup by the small communist group, which then quickly was followed by the Soviet invasion. And I would contend that from that day to this, we are still in the aftermath and the after effects of the Soviet invasion. The Soviet invasion pretty much destroyed the fabric of the country. You know, the 6 million refugees that it drove out of the country, the destruction of the villages, the tearing apart of the tribal structures, and the creation of a state of war in which, you know, the old traditional Afghan systems for generating leadership gave way to a new system, which was, in that state of chaos, if you had a gun and you were good with it, you were probably going to end up being an important guy. So that, you know, brought into being a whole other class of Afghan, you know, leaders who are commanders. Now they call them warlords. And that entered the fray. When the Soviets left, those guys all started fighting each other, and they tore the cities apart. And then in the wake of that came the Taliban. And so now we're in the country, and I think we have come in with something of the same idea that the Soviets had, which was, this is a primitive country in a lot of trouble, and if we can restore everything and produce material benefits for the people, they will be grateful and they will come over to our side. And there's more to it than that, however. I mean, Afghans are very interested in material benefits like anyone is, but there is a question of the reconstruction of the Afghan institutions, the society, the soul, the family structure, and the reconciliation of all these contending factors on the Afghan scene. This Taliban business is not completely separate from the contentions within Afghan society over dominating the identity of Afghanistan. How much time have I used? I can keep going? Yeah. All right. I was so efficient that I said almost everything I have to say. So now I could go back into all of that at great length. But I will just say this, that, I went back to Afghanistan in 2012, this last year, and part of my mission was to help a group take bare root trees to different villages and plant them. And so we went to some distance from Kabul. We didn't go to the really war-torn areas because they're war-torn, you know. We were timid. But we went where we could. And we went, for example, to my home ancestral village near Kabul. And then we went out to Parwan and some further districts. And I saw things in Afghanistan were interesting for me, because what I saw was, on the one hand, there were aspects of the modern world that to me were permeating to the furthest reaches of rural Afghanistan. Actually, I went to central Afghanistan, where those Bamiyan Buddhas used to be. You might remember those. They were destroyed by the Taliban. And then from there, we went out on a, we wanted to see something someone told us about that was a rock structure. So that was like a couple of hours drive out of the little town of Bamiyan. So we're really way out, you know, in the middle of nowhere. And there, I look out and I see a little village clinging to the cliffs. And I see something glimmering white. And I go, what is that? You know, so we look closer. And what it is it's a solar panel. And even in those distant places, they know about solar panels. And next to that solar panel, what do you call those things? Satellite dish. So this village has at least enough electricity from the solar panel to run at least one television set. Probably not more than one, you know, because that's expensive, and that village will have that one television set in some common area that people will come together in. But that in itself is a permeation of the outside world into Afghanistan. And you might say, well, what can you get on a television set in central Afghanistan? Well, you can get programming from Kabul. And oh my goodness, you know, there's like so much programming coming out of Kabul. They have like 20 TV stations. Now, it's true that those are a motley crew of TV stations. Some of them are owned by, dare I call them, warlords, you know. So there is a certain element of control of public information that way. But at the same time, some of these TV stations in Kabul are putting out such aggressive investigative news, you guys would be proud of it. You know, they go to the places where these you know, where these suicide bombings have taken place, they find video and they broadcast it, and that has an effect on public opinion, where if you just hear, oh, you know, some place was bombed, you can manipulate the spin on that information in a different way than when you see people dying. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is they've aggressively called to the carpet Afghan officials who are involved in putative corruption. And they bring up documents and they question them. Not that that's stopped any of the corruption, but I think it's important that the media exists and people even in these distant villages can see it. On the other hand, you know, I will tell you that I went there and I stayed with my a relative of mine, and he's you know, someone I never met, but closely tied to the village. But you know, he's I don't know, second cousin or something, very close in Afghan terms. and I went to his house, and it was 2 days before I saw his wife, because it wasn't clear that I was close enough to the family to be admitted to the inner circle. And then I will also report to you that after that, it was like, okay, this guy is family. And then our dinners shifted from just him and me and the boy children to the family dinner. And so then we were all together there. And so now you will say to yourselves, the woman was kept in a back room and she was an oppressed something or other. but I tell you, once we were all together, I was saying, well, I want to go there and do this. And the wife was saying, you're not going to go there and do that. You're going to the village to visit the shrine of our great-great ancestor. I don't have time. No, you're going to make time. So there was not anything squelched about this woman. There is a structure that was characteristic of Afghan society in the distant past in my day in Afghanistan, and it's still there all over the country. So the negotiation of the old Afghanistan and the culture of the outside world is very deeply mixed up with what's going to happen going forward. I'll just stop there.
Thank you very much, Tamim, and made my job so much easier because I'm not a historian and not analytical as Tamim is. But I'm just so fortunate and to be here in the position to be able to speak on behalf of the Afghan people. And the reason I really took and embarked on this journey to write Lost Decency is indeed for the Afghan people, for the innocent, for millions of people who have had nothing to do with the decisions of a few that put them in the miseries that we are today. So my mission is indeed that, and that is what I wrote the book, to start to be part of this dialogue, to talk about the decency of human beings and the loss of decency. And that's what's very important to me. So in that regard, I want to apologize to you that, or other people that I speak to, groups to, when I sound judgmental, because when you talk about the social aspects of life and people and you defend them, it is very difficult, especially in today's environment where there are so many different opinions and so many extreme ideas, if you will. It's not just extremists are fighting out there, but extreme ideas right here within our own societies. It's amazing. So they put me in a position that said, oh, my God, who are you to tell us this? Or why don't you go back to your own country if you don't like it? And my answer to that is like, you know, I'm a great citizen of the United States. Not just an average citizen, but I do things that an average citizen would not do. So, and I'm a great Afghan. I'm an Afghan American. But I'm a human race, and I'm here to represent decent people. So that's what I tell them, and I said, please don't be judgmental. So I was in Carlsbad, a library, not too long ago in San Diego, and a lady who was actually a little bit upset about, I guess, what she knew about Afghanistan. And one of her questions was, so what do people of Afghanistan want, Mr. Argandewal? I mean, it was really, I said, great question. I said, what would you like in life? What do you like? I said, I really want to know, what do you want in life? I said, a home, bread, you know, three meals and all. I said, well, great. I said, that's exactly what the people of Afghanistan want, a roof on their head. I said, not three meals. How about one meal a day? That's not even available. So I said, that's what they want. But it's how things are prioritized today in the world. That's how politicians are prioritizing things in this world where people are suffering. And it's not because of lack of money. There is more money in this world than you can imagine. I can tell you, I'm a banker. Okay, so I was in banking for 28-some-odd years, and I've been in all aspects of it. And there is no lack of money on this earth, but it's how it's prioritized and distributed. Not distribution, not necessarily to take it away from people, but it's how it's prioritized by governments. So again, my mission was to talk about, again, open up this dialogue, and to really go back and take people back towards the real Afghanistan, the peaceful Afghanistan that I was privileged to live in, grow at. And quite frankly, Afghanistan, after 1919, I would say that it had its own share of peaceful and time and prosperity. We call it prosperous, and my mother calls it, you know, prosperity. You know, not really developed, but she really likes it. I said, I wish we would go back to that environment where it was one of the most peaceful spots around the world. Where during my upbringing, where we were tourists will all from all over the world will come in and enjoy Afghanistan. What I would, as a guide, as a tour guide, will take him to Bamyan and beyond in Badakhshan and areas where they will be considered a guest of that village. And by the way, a country where killing of a person will be more than each and every village around Afghanistan. That's what the Afghanistan that I want to tell people about. We did. Our father will tell us, and actually there will be somebody's prayer that we would go to. On what? And they said, oh, somebody has been killed in Herat, and we will go to there. So that's the environment we're talking about. And I want to talk to people about the fact that Afghanistan was never a corrupt nation. It's not okay to call, and it is called, in a corrupt nation today, but corruption was imported and was deposed and brought over people of Afghanistan, especially in the last 13, 14 years. And when people emigrated, when people went as refugees to neighboring countries, and the warlords and others, and the people started to fight, trade ammunition, sell people, sell human beings, and that's when corruption came in. That's when it started. I remember in the village, in the place where I lived in Sharara, where actually a bribe taker would be very well known as to who he was, and everybody wanted to stay away in that village, in that whole area, would be ashamed of having a bribe taker. Today, it's common business all over as we know it. That's the Afghanistan that we knew. But what was the model that the king and others used, as Mr. Ansari referred to? What was really the benefit? And what did he do? And I wish and I pray that there was a model that the world will realize and know that that's the model to bring back. And how do you buy people's minds and hearts? What was it? What kept the entire Afghan society so close together? What is this about factionism? What about Pashtunism and Farsis and this? And are you serious? I ask. We lived within a Sharara area where every single ethnicity lived together. We played together. We played soccer. I coached them. My sisters went to school with them. We had no problem. We could actually go, you know, just raise on our tables, and we could see our neighbor and talk to them and get some, you know, borrow a little bread or a piece of whatever. That's the society Afghanistan was. So what you're hearing is not what it was. What you're seeing on the images on TV, it's not what Afghanistan was. And that's what really hurts. That's my mission, to talk to people and to actually even bring it to the world's attention, to say that the models we're using is the wrong model. When I went back, after all these years, and I was hurting, I was the first after 9/11. We were hurting so bad. That was one of the days that you could only read in my book. Well, other stories are there, but for my story, just read my story of 9/11 and how I left my home and what happened. And I was a senior VP in Washington Mutual at the time when I had a meeting with my managers. And that day only, you know, I can't even tell you how that day went through, but how it hurt to be an Afghan and to know that the attacks on my own country here, on the United States, is launched from my own native country. That was very hurtful. So that's why I was on a mission to go back and do something. And I wanted to go and help. I really wanted to go help. I had a plan, a 10-point plan, very easy. But really with little skills, with only high school education, I could have done some things that these people didn't do until this date. But it's not about me. It's about the fact that priorities were again missed. We missed those priorities to go back and gain the hearts and minds of people. So when I went back again to Afghanistan and I saw what I saw, like Tamim did, I just could not believe what I saw. So again, it's not lack of money, and you cannot buy people with money. As I walked out of the airport, this 10-year-old that walked to me right away and said, "I want to shine your shoes." I realized that he was ready, and I said, "No, no, no." And he said, "No, please let me do it." I said, "I'm going to give you this $10. The first thing he asked was, "Come from America?" And when he said, "Come from," I said, "How did you know?" Well, I said, "Well, unfortunately, they gave out money. They throw money." So a 10-year-old who actually supports 7 members of the family, and then I actually begged him, to be honest with you, because he did not want to get the money without shining the shoes. I said, "Do it for me. Do it as a gift. Do it for your sisters. Just take this." So I guess I gave him $20. But the point is that people may not be educated, but they are not stupid. There is a difference that the world today does not understand. That's why this lady asked me, what do people of Afghanistan want? Because they believe that they think like they're all criminals. They're not. They're good people. They're innocent. They've been victimized. Read the history. They've been victimized for years and years. They've been abandoned. There is a section in my book that says, you know, Afghanistan, Kabul, or Afghanistan abandoned, deserted. I said, that's exactly what happened. How is it possible for the world to allow a Saudi Arabia national to go and rule another country? What happened? How is it possible for those outlaws of Middle East and others to go and build another country or actually rule other nations? Did we go to sleep? Well, here is the cost today. Look at what's doing to us. Look at what's happening. So the point is, again, my whole focus has been really to talk about the real great Afghanistan, the Peace Corps days, where basically a lot of Western societies and governments were building high schools in Afghanistan, where tourists were there, where Peace Corps organization was there. There were some good things happening. We were growing. We were making progress. Our sisters were going to school. They were, we had, you know, things going. It was looking good. And then, of course, you know, here comes the, you know, Russians, and here comes the neighbors, you know, trying to get their hands in the affairs of Afghan people. And the rest is history, because I don't want to go through any of those steps. But again, it's really a tragedy as to what has really happened to Afghanistan. It really is. Again, my mission is to be able to talk about that, talk about the qualities of the past. And I'm very engaged in the Afghan society, in the community, and trying to really not only enlighten them, but encourage them and challenge them to become the best citizens that they can be, whether they're here or anywhere around the world, to really stand on their feet and to not accept the fact that today that their country is known as one of the most corrupt nations, or a country that's known for opium, top opium producer around the world. There's nothing to be proud of that. And Afghans should understand that, but do something about it, not only around the world, but inside Kabul. You know, to go on a peaceful type of uprising, start thinking, starting becoming educated, put out those arms. It's not going to happen. I was doing some studies as part of my book, you know, Comments and Reserves, that I know now who are the top producers of weapons, and I know who's planting all those bombs and, you know, grenades inside all over Afghanistan. I know who they are. But that's why those things are not the solution. It is not going to accomplish anything. For as long as we have arms, for as long as we have wars, we will not have peace, we will not have stability, we will not have security. Thank you.
Thank you, Atta, and thank you, Tamim. So now it's time for the Q&A of this program, and I'm Robert Rosenthal, your moderator for today. We have a lot of questions, but because there's two such distinguished and knowledgeable people here, we're going to have more of a conversation, so I hope you guys sort of get involved with each other, and I'll sort of be the guide here today. But I think, you know, one of the things that's clear is that the West and America, you know, did not understand, does not really truly understand Afghanistan. Historically, we've seen that happen over and over again. When you, in Tamim's book, you talk about the Great Game 1, the Great Game 2, what the Russians did when they came in. Will you maybe, Tamim, start off talking about the role and what you both also mentioned today in your brief presentations for your families and the scale of the families, but the role of family, clan, and the interrelationships which lead to the definition, which I think may be uniquely Afghan, about what leadership means. So, and you address that in your book. So maybe you can start, Tamim, talking about that. And Atta, please join in.
Sure. Well, you know, the first thing to talk about, excuse me, is the extent to which life in Afghanistan is shaped by networks of personal relationships. And I would draw the contrast to here that we're familiar with a society in which there's a lot of impersonal institutions, and we think of, say, getting a job, you go, you fill out an application, and so on. In Afghanistan, the age-old idea is if you want to get a job, you go talk to someone who knows how to get you a job. Now, that, I think, might sound like corruption once you mix the two systems together, but you have to remember that, you know, the original Afghanistan was a world in which there were sort of no appointed officials. Everybody knew each other in the area where they lived. Everybody was somebody in a family structure. And there were networks of relationships and patronage that were, you know, that evolved through someone doing a favor for somebody, not as a buy and sell kind of thing, you know, not, I did this for you, now you owe me one. It's just building a relationship. And then over the course of time, those relationships extend over generations, and people whose fathers were eminent and did great things, they have a little up on being a more important person. But they have to secure that by their own great deeds. There is a intricate social network of do's and don'ts and shoulds and shouldn'ts that nobody actually could tell you what they are. Afghans just know it. And in a social interaction, those who do that gracefully and well gain prestige. Those who do that awkwardly, clumsily, and insult other people, they lose prestige. So how people become leaders is a subtle, interpersonal, interactive process. And that's the grassroots Afghanistan. That's how village elders, for example, emerge. And that's how even clerics emerge. You know, people who want to be the mullah of the village, they're not appointed. They go hang around with the existing mullah of the village. They learn how that works. After a while, they've been so helpful, they're just part of the scene there. And then that old mullah dies, they're just the mullah. That's how, you know, and then if there are disputes to be adjudicated in a village, and this is still the case in many villages, the people of the village, the men of the village, they gather and they have a tribal council and they discuss that matter, whatever it is. Criminal matters are often discussed that way, or disputes about land or something like that. Nobody's appointed to that council. It's the prestigious people sit closer to the center, and the people who have less prestige are on the outsides going, what's going on? That system of finding leaders at the local level in the original society of Afghanistan recapitulates all the way up the line. And that's the way that families negotiate with each other, and clans negotiate with each other, and even tribes. And I will just add one other thing, which is to say that although there's this country is divided into many tribes and its many clans and so on, it is not the case that the tribes and clans were always fighting each other. You know, they lived in their separate areas and they interacted in various ways, and they didn't fight all the time. Sometimes they fought, but not all the time.
Tony, you want to follow up on that?
A quick point, a really great explanation. And I think Afghanistan had, that history that at least I grew up, had great leaders. And again, these were tribesmen, and my uncle would be one. It's a phenomenal impact that he had on the village of Argandeh. And people like that. And my father, who actually was just there helping everybody in any time without, you know, right in the within communities. So I think Afghanistan had this within the tribal society, had an incredible number of leaders in the style. And today that there is a real big gap in not having that. And guess who are the leaders, the so-called leaders, the commanders that Tamim referred to, who had fought and had never been to school or had no education. And today they are they have massive, you know, support of their constituents and of course, and armies and a lot of money. So just imagine now there's this huge gap, and that's why there is hope for the educated to come in and fill that gap. And there's a real big gap right now because, again, look who the leaders are.
So let me just add one other thing, which is that because of that system of leadership emerging, I think what's misunderstood by outside interveners is that when you set up a rational process and gather people that are identified and then somebody's elected as leader, that guy's not necessarily the leader. You know, he's now been ratified by the U.S. in a meeting that the U.S. has set up, and now he's got a title. He's the president. But is he really a leader? Maybe he is, but he has to shore up that leadership by operating in that whole other system as well.
So we're now at a point where the U.S. is preparing or hoping to leave, and this foundation of understanding Afghan culture and the role of the family and what defines leadership and what makes the culture work and the richness, Atta, you described. So let's go forward. I got two questions, really. How did they not learn from the past, and what lessons should we have learned when we went in there? And going forward now, where is a solution to potentially stabilizing? Can you see that happening?
Sure. I believe we had a great opportunity as devastating the attacks of 9/11 were. You know, stuff it was for everybody. Somebody did ask me, and they said, what now? I said, you know, I'm really sad to say, but it's like a lottery, where now Afghanistan has a chance to come out of this whole misery and to build. And we have an opportunity to go build a model, if you will, and to do that because people were on the run. People were on the run. We had great times to recruit and build a national army. That should have been like the number one priority, to build a strong national army like the past, where people could have defended their own country and be paid. But instead, of course, we went to the warlords. We went to the commanders and said, you know, here's a bag of money. Go and build your own army. So what it did was it's kind of brought in a different type of cultural environment into the and I think took the real leadership, or back going to the earlier conversation, the control of the village or the respect to the elder. Those things were then now stopped. So I think it was a huge mistake in that regard that we did not really address from the very beginning to understand the cultural aspects of that society, build an army, and actually build the country in a way, in the infrastructure, to really gain support of the public. And again, when you go and address the needs of the few and leave the masses out, guess what happens? That's again, a big loss. But going forward, for me again, I wish and I hope that there is a way that we can go back and depend and rely on those tribal leaders. Get them back to defend their own little area. Give them real support, not cash, but give them real support and structure to build their own areas. And if we don't gain the support of all these tribal areas and all, there will not be peace in Afghanistan, I can assure you.
Well, you know, I just want to first say that I don't want to come off as saying Afghanistan turned into a mess because a lot of stupid people made a lot of dumb mistakes. I think Afghanistan is a mess because it was really hard to fix that, and there was a lot of complications. And, with the question of building a national army, the question was first and remains. You've got an army. We do have an army in Afghanistan now. It's a professional army. They're paid. But the question is, when the foreign forces leave, and if there's any interruption of their pay, whose army is that? There has to be the development of the sense of leadership of the people who are in charge of that army that will enable the people in that army to say, yes, these are our leaders. We are the army of this country. So that's the problem. If we want to go back to 2002 and what happened there, anyone can give their opinions. But to me, the major thing that the U.S. didn't do was to go in there with a lot of small scale but really distributed help. And it also did not do something that I know is very difficult to do, but it did not cede control of the development monies that it was bringing in to Afghans, because it's understandable to some extent. You know, we're talking about technocrats, experts, and they know what's right, and they know what's, and they're worried that Afghans will screw it up. But you have to allow for Afghans to take charge of their own destiny, because that's how you build. That's what enables a generation of Afghans to come into leadership. And if you just go in there and do it, for example, bring in the engineers, hire some Afghans to break rocks and build a highway from one major city to another, you've sidelined all the Afghans along the road in every part of the process, and you've just given Afghanistan a highway. Well, that doesn't really help Afghans. You gotta do it in such a way that Afghans are participants in the development. Now, there were ways to do that. It gets into extreme detail, so I'm not going to bother you about that, but that's the general principle, I think.
Some of what you're both saying is if you think there is an Afghan solution, if the Afghans were left alone to do it. But the reality right now is that whether you're the Pakistanis, even the Russians, the Iranians, the U.S., other interests, China with the mineral wealth, and the Taliban. So how do you see the next period of years with all those forces at work, and what will the role of the Taliban actually be, or do you see them having a productive role possibly?
Well, if you're only thinking of the U.S. presence in Afghanistan as being about helping Afghans, I think you're in trouble there. You know, there is a certain sense of, the U.S. owes, the U.S. doesn't owe Afghanistan You know, Afghans are not entitled to be fixed up by the United States. Afghans have to fix their own country. The U.S. is there for a different reason. The U.S. is there because, like all the great powers of the past, it does actually have strategic interests in Afghanistan. And my thesis is it can best serve those strategic interests by having a independent, autonomous Afghanistan that is friendly to the United States. That would be perfect. Then the U.S. would have an actual, ally that's strongly associated with and will not cut its ties with, being a Muslim country, and it's right in Central Asia. It needs that. The domination of Afghanistan is going to hurt U.S. interests, but I think the U.S. does have to be there because of all these things you said. There's Pakistan. Those guys are going to be swarming in 2 days after there's a power vacuum in there, and that'll be a mess for Afghans too. So,
very true. Again, there is outside interest, and then there is bigger, I would say, question than there is just inside Afghanistan as to how you control the neighbors and what did you do, what is the interest in there. Look at the latest example of that border area of Afghanistan and Pakistan, where now suddenly, as a conspiracy, it is a true conspiracy, where basically now suddenly there is an attack on both sides and trying to actually question the line that was drawn many, many years back. And I said, are you serious? That's all of the problems in a little land area or mountainous area that we're going to question as to who it belongs to while we have all these problems. So that's the hand of the foreign, whoever is, whether it be one neighbor or another. Those are the kind of distractions that are really stopping. So again, as far as the long term, like Tim, you mentioned that there got to be a better strategy to really address the needs of those and then control of these neighbors, because as long as they have their hands in the Afghan affair, it will be extremely difficult.
We'd like to remind our listening audiences that this is the Commonwealth Club program called Afghanistan. Our speakers are Tamim Ansari and Atta Argandiwal. And let's go on with another question. Atta, in your book, you have some wonderful personal scenes. The day 9/11 happened, that's very powerful in your own life. But when you return to Afghanistan, there's a great description or scene around with the corrupt officials and the party you went to at the private home. Nice. But one of the things that I found most memorable was the visit to your family's home village. And in that, you visit your father's grave, but also I talked to you earlier about your visit to the mosque, and when you went to the mosque, there were Taliban there. So I want to get back to the Taliban. Can you describe that scene, and also, again, what role might they have going forward? Can it be a productive role and a critical role, and just maybe address that a little as well as bring us to that moment?
It really was an eye-opener when I did go to Kabul, and when I told my cousin that, that was the first order of the day to go in. And we left early morning, and it was just kind of going back to the old days, and it was snowing. And it was just crisp early morning leaving towards the village as we made it there. And one of the first things I was told that it is Friday, of course, and it's going to be a prayer. I said, what a wonderful opportunity to be able to connect with so many, which we did. And by the way, my cousin says that there will be some Taliban in there. I said, oh, good. I said, what do you mean? I said, I really want to talk to them. I said, I'd like to, again, this will be my first opportunity ever to find out who are these, what about? I said, in our own village, Argandi? And he said, yes, because they do go out and they spread out, but they come whenever, they have families. So I said, that's a wonderful opportunity. But then on that day, and the mosque was full because then they had found out that I was coming. And not because of me, to be honest with you, but because my brother was such a great fighter for 10 years. He was well known. And we had lost him, by the way, in the United States 3 years ago to cancer. But he was very well known, and he was like a champion to them. And he knew that I was a brother. So they had great respect. And this mosque completely filled up. I mean, it was people outside lining up, and we all prayed together. And at the end, I said, I really want to meet with these boys. And which we did. And I will tell you that I could not find a older person than 25 years old in those Taliban group, which was really, really sad. These were 18, 17, 19-year-old, young, incredible features that you could see, and with long beards and then with their guns. And so I said, one of the questions quickly was that, so I said, what do they pay them? what is this? And he said, well, I believe they're averaging about $50 a month. And because they have no jobs. And again, now, take a look at this. This village is only 18 kilometers away from the capital. And there was not a single school, except for one school that has been built by a gentleman that lives in Concord. He went and built a school. So again, when I talk about priorities, where there could have been a school, there could have been a place where these kids could have been going to, but it was not addressed. The village is old. The village is, it's just like as it looked. I think like it's almost nothing has moved, honestly. It was amazing. But the point was that I saw, again, loss of decency, lack of opportunity, loss of opportunity to grow these people, these kids, with an embed them into the society. So that brings me quickly to the next point, which is actually there are two different types of Taliban that we call them. There are local Taliban that are really people of, you know, Afghan people like these kids that have no idea what it is, and they just get paid and they get for a religious purpose or something, or their national pride has been somehow been attacked now because they're foreign soldiers on their soil. These people should be embedded. These people should be brought in. They're part of the society. And then you got the extremists, which are not really too many, but they disrupt that society. And these are the people that are walking from the borders from, you know, Chechnya or whoever, Saudi Arabia or all other countries, and they are all on that mountainous area of Pakistan. So it's a nightmare for Afghan people, where they know that that's a kind of threat that exists. But as far as a place for the Taliban, in the moderate Taliban in the future, absolutely. They should be brought in, and they should be given autonomy. They should be given a place to build their own society, be a part of the solution rather than fight.
I mean, I'd like you to also address that question. And one of the most powerful elements I found in, excuse me, in your book was schools and what's happened to schools. And you use the schools as a symbol for so many different things. So maybe you could tie that into your thoughts on the Taliban and also some examples of what you don't think is such a good thing they're doing.
Well, there's one thing to say about schools, which is schools, we tend to think of them, we tend to use the word school and then think of it as a neutral good the way you would think of medical care. And actually, the Taliban also had schools. The contention was about what kind of schools. They had like 30,000 of these schools along the border where they taught, fundamentalist, jihadist Islamist ideology, Quran, sayings of the Prophet and so on, and also in many of them, they taught them how to shoot guns. So when we or anybody puts schools in areas where there is conflict, that's also part of the conflict. So I just want everybody to be aware of that. And one of the turning points of the post 9/11 reconstruction of Afghanistan came during the year 2006 when there was 200 school burning or attacks on schools and closing down of the schools, really traumatized people in those areas where those schools were. And those schools were all in, like, you know, Helmand province and those areas that were not very well under control. And so in a way, the children were made hostages to the war of the older folks, and that was a terrible thing. The other thing I want to say about schools is, although many, many schools have been built now, and there are 2.2 million girls that are in school, I think, there's still a real crisis about schooling, and there's still a big problem in it, I would say. And with girls' schooling, one of the problems is that the culture still has the conservative culture still has so much control that it's able to restrict the education of girls of a certain age by men. So there are people who say, well, we're not against girls' education, but they have to be taught by women. But now the problem is that there was that dark ages when women were not being educated because of the Taliban control of Afghanistan. So there's a gap there of women who can teach girls. And so there's women who are teaching young girls, and they themselves are studying the next grade up as hard as they can so that they can stay ahead of their students. So that's a problem. The other problem that I saw, and it's just my opinion, but when I went to Kabul, in my day there were a number of schools, and they were opened by the government, and there was a curriculum there. Now there's hundreds of schools. People send their kids to private schools and not to these big public schools, and they specialize in very technical education. They specialize in, there's the University of Microsoft Word or something like that. I think that kind of schooling, when it replaces the kind of schooling where you learn literature, geography, history, the history of your own country, all of that stuff, it tends to add to the fragmentation. So I think there has to be some commitment to rebuilding schools as a unifying force in the society. And I have 17 more things to say about schools, but I think I'll stop there.
Okay, so there have been several questions from the audience about clarity on trying to understand, really for the Western American audience, the role of Islam in Afghan society and the difference, or is it, several of the questions are, is there more of a Sunni or a Shia influence, and the role potentially of Sharia also in Afghan, not only the future, but obviously had an influence in the past. So I don't know if you want to take that on, whoever would like to answer.
Surely.
That.
What I quickly want to comment on that is that we had enjoyed just a remarkable, benefit of religion during our upbringing. Were this again Sunni Shia and these factors? Actually, this wasn't really a factor at all. It was really we respected. We respected to go to each other's mosques and collaborate and talk and respect. But it really has taken a different form. And to be honest with you, it's a lot of it is again the work of neighbors. I was very stunned when I saw the activities of some of the neighbors that are trying to separate the Shias from the Sunnis inside Kabul. It was devastating just to see that. So, and they say that they're all basically funded by these outside sources. So that's kind of, again, quickly, I know there's not enough time to talk about the real other the details of that, but that's what's happening. So there is, the outside influence is enormous and it plays a role, and it was never a factor in the past. But today, still, it's something that brings people together, because that is Islam, and that's the first thing they look at. That's one of the uniters.
I'm going to set aside Sunni Shia, because I don't think that's the important question to ask. But I think that in the old Afghanistan, Islam was like a atmosphere. It just was everywhere, and it wasn't a separate thing from just daily life. And Afghans, they considered themselves very devout Muslims. They wouldn't even say I'm religious, because what does that mean? It's just being a good person is being a good Muslim. But it was a soft kind of Islam that was mixed in ways people didn't bother to differentiate with customs and folkways and so on. And I think that in the course of these wars, the thing that happened is that this other kind of hard-edged, doctrinaire Islam that is preached by international jihadist revolutionaries, that came into Afghanistan. And I believe that some Afghans, younger Afghans, are sympathetic to that, partly because the old ways have been so destroyed that people have lost their connection to their own history. So they're grasping for something, and this stuff, it just comes in as a package, and you can take the whole thing. So I'd say forget about Sunni Shia. Talk about conventional conservative Islam, old-fashioned Islam, and this politicized jihadist Islam. That's a whole different thing.
And I really appreciate the soft side, because we were encouraged. Just go to, we were not like pushed to go to the mosque and do that. I mean, it was part of what we wanted to do, because it was embraced rather than being forced in a different, and that's actually, you're so right about the threat that exists, what it is now, the extreme that is brought upon these people that actually have no real education. And so they grasp that, they grab it as a, and again, no employment, no jobs, no nothing. And here we go, they are now associated with these thoughts and these things. And by the way, in the name of Islam and the name of nationality and basically to tell people that they are being threatened, that there are countries being occupied. So now this nationalism comes into it.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we're getting near the end of the program, so I'm going to ask one last question and like you both to answer it or say whatever you like, because we only have a few minutes. But we are where we are today. It's obviously a tumultuous, chaotic moment. The future is unclear for Afghanistan. But can you frame a last question? There have been also a lot of questions from the audience about the role of women and going forward. Can you lay out what you hope happens in the next cycle, and also what role you hope women will have in the emerging and changing Afghanistan?
I will just say this, that in that golden period, you know, when you and I grew up in Afghanistan and there was a rapid development of the liberation and empowerment of women, it was plain that, you know, that Afghan women have powerful leadership within them, and that Afghan society is very capable of adjusting to and accommodating so that it becomes a society in which men and women have an equal place in public life. Afghans can do it. I'll echo Atta's refrain here. Outsiders can spoil it.
I think very well stated. And, you know, that's a tough thing. And there's a real barrier now, that how to overcome that and to really open up. But something that really hurts personally that I've saw that or seen nothing of, not a whole lot of support from national leadership of Afghanistan in terms of support of Afghans. What has been Afghan women and what has been brought in is basically a lot of the outside forces, or actually the international community, that have done a great job in trying to really encourage the women to come into the fold. But the leadership itself has really failed as far as I'm concerned.
We actually have a couple more minutes, I've been told, so I'm going to ask another question. Going forward in the aftermath of the U.S. involvement, if you're an Afghan now, how do you perceive the Russian intervention and the American intervention? Are we sort of coming to a place where the Afghans perceive both the Russians and the U.S. as similar occupiers?
Well, you know, I went back to Afghanistan twice, and those two times in 2002, right after the Taliban were driven out, and in 2012, last year, after, you know, 10 years of the Americans being there. And in 2002, when I went there, everything I saw had been reduced to rubble, just about. The physical country was more destroyed than any place I've ever seen. And yet, I felt like the social atmosphere of the country was just not changed at all since I was there. It was the Afghanistan I knew. I come back 10 years later, and I feel like the country has changed more in the last 10 years than it did in the previous 38. And there's no rubble. Wherever there was rubble, now there's a skyscraper, probably a wedding palace, you know, where some rich person has 1,000 guests for a wedding. I feel that, you know, there is some way in which the Afghan soul was able to stand up to bombs but was not able to stand up to dollars.
Atta?
You're right. I did go for that question. I did go in search of that answer to that question as to why now we're looked at as occupiers. And it's, again, as I referred to at the beginning, it's about priorities and what they see. And I know the woman that with 12 or 11 children that told me, they said, you know, I said, why do you see, why? And she was trying really tough talk about America. And I said, why? And he said, well, it's not for us. It's not for me. It's not for my children. What's the difference? It's for the few. That answers the questions. It's really for the answer and the benefit of a few, not for the masses. And that's why they look at this very differently. Otherwise, they're in need of help, and they're in need of that 1 meal a day, remember.
Okay. Our thanks to Tamin Ansari, the author of Game Without Rules, The Often Interrupted History of Afghanistan. He's the director of the San Francisco Writers Workshop, and I also want to thank Atta Agarwal, who describes himself also as a banker, but he's really a writer now, and on a mission, clearly. His book, Lost Decency, The Untold Story, Afghan Story, are both available outside. We also want to thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to the recording and on the Internet. I'm Robert Rosenthal, Executive Director of the Center for Investigative Reporting. Now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating 110 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.